Hello and welcome to the Geek and Review Podcast. I'm Jeremy Pappas, alongside, as always, Deck the Halls with Russell Jones. Russell.
We will be both gay and merry because, damn it, tradition.
You sure you don't want to be,
fun? Holiday,
yeah, fun and merry. Fun and merry, yeah.
Yeah.
There was some flack I saw in the news not too long ago. There were some shirts at Target that said, let's be fun and merry, and people were pissed off that it didn't say gay because blah, blah, blah.
Don We Now Are Fun Apparel.
That's right. Don We Now Are Fun Apparel, which, you know, I understand not putting gay on a shirt because the meaning of gay has changed since that was written, but fun apparel? I mean, it doesn't really, it doesn't mean the same thing.
It's like,
gay apparel is like your, it's your party clothes. It's the stuff you wear to go and have fun. It's not like, you know what I mean.
Yeah. Patton Oswalt does a bit where he talks about how his producers will come to him and ask him to say stuff that's, you know, G-rated in place of, you know, sexual descriptions. And he says, that just makes it worse.
Yeah, it does.
It just makes it worse.
It does. Definitely. Saying fun apparel instead of gay apparel made everyone think, oh, huh, gay apparel. Gay is another word for homosexuality. Okay. Which, you know, it's Streisand's law. The more you gripe about something on the internet, the more people see it.
Yep.
Anyway, what are you up to?
Oh, just trying to get back in the swing of things. It's been a crazy few days with Thanksgiving and everything. We had a great time. Great, great time. At Thanksgiving with all the lovely people that we go have a, you know, local theater potluck with, and there were campfires, and I consumed both a half bottle of scotch and a half bottle of mead. So Friday, working all day, I was, you know, miserable. But let me tell you, Five Guys Burger and Fries, hangover panacea.
Yeah, that'll do it.
I had a headache, my stomach was crap, I felt like blah, blah, blah. I got a bacon cheeseburger. Mm-hmm. And a thing of fries, and after that I was like, holy crap, I feel human.
It's like magic, but delicious.
Really is. Delicious, delicious magic.
I had a little Friendsgiving last night, which was nice. It's something I've wanted to do for quite a while. I had quite a few people over to my not-super-big house. So we were packed in there, but it was a good time. I made a ham, because everyone was tired of turkey. Ham turned out really good. I made bacon mashed potatoes, which were also a big hit. And, we had a big thing. Everyone came, we ate, we drank, we made merry, we played games, we, donated merry to a charity. It was a lot of fun. But now the holiday Thanksgiving is behind us. We're looking ahead toward Christmas. It'll be a couple weeks before I put up my tree because I don't like it that Christmas takes over the whole month of December, which is a good month all by itself, not just having Christmas in it.
And, you know, a lot of November as well in some cases.
And most of November, too, yeah. If you're a hiker, December's a fantastic month to go hiking. Not quite as good as your September, Octobers, but quite good.
We actually dropped into freezing temperatures in Louisiana this week for a couple of days. Day before Thanksgiving, day of Thanksgiving, it was, you know, 25 degrees overnight. It was very, very nice. And now it looks like we're going to be back up into the 70s on Monday, which is depressing. It's like I go to work in the middle of December in short sleeves. I'm like, no.
This is wrong.
Why? It's like the people who live in the Pacific Northwest or in Canada and don't see sun for, you know, months out of the year, and they get kind of depressed because of that. I get depressed when it's 70 and sunny in the winter.
Right.
That's one of the things that I loved about living in Central and Northwest Arkansas was that we at least got all four seasons.
Yeah, you get – there's a nice, hot, humid, gross summer. We get a nice fall, though the lines have been blurred a little recently. It seems like now we go from boiling hot to freezing cold. And the weird thing is the line has sort of become jagged, where one day it'll be 40, the next day it'll be 80, the next day it'll be 30, the next day it'll be 70. Like, what's going on? But eventually you get to where it's reliably cold outside, so, you know, you start feeling a little better. Today we got some really interesting news in the email straight away. This morning it was an email from Wizards of the Coast. By we, I mean virtually everyone who's signed up for the D&D Next playtest. The email from Wizards of the Coast had to do with the character creator and the dungeon tools online. Now, why for 4th edition? Now, why does this mean anything that we should be at all interested in?
Well, here's exactly what it says. We're looking at the future launch of D&D Next, shifting focus in development, and this affects those who have a D&D Insider subscription. Because I have a 4th edition game running, so I'm still paying to have access to all the nice tools online and the digital stuff, you know, that you get by having a DDI subscription.
Which were fantastic back when I had a 4th edition game going on.
Oh, yeah. We
were playing a ton of 4th edition. That was one of the really big wins, I think, in my opinion, for 4th edition was all those online tools. They were really, really well done.
Exactly. I felt a little iffy whenever they switched from a downloadable, you know, program that you have on your computer, like an application that you run,
uh-huh,
and instead switched to an entirely cloud-based thing. I was, but you know what? I came to like it.
Mm-hmm.
And it took them forever to finally get to a place where they had some decent digital tools, but now that they have them, they're updating people to let them know that you will still be able to get access to 4th edition magazines and tools starting in March of 2014. The DDI tool set, which includes the character builder, adventure tools, and the compendium, will no longer be updated with new 4th edition game content. Mm-hmm. Existing issues of Dungeon Magazine and Dragon Magazine will continue to be offered for viewing. So, it's interesting because they're basically saying, here is where we're putting the stop on 4th edition DDI resources. You will still be able to access them. It's just that they won't be kept up in terms of, you know, if there are new articles that are published.
Right.
Exactly. You know, stuff that's out there is now just going to be out there. It's not going to be, you know, wholly kept in. Why, you ask? Because they're probably going to make the transition very shortly over to D&D Next.
Right.
And possibly, I mean, I think here's the biggest question of all. Are they going to continue to provide the same digital tools that they provided for 4th edition for Next? I think it makes sense for them to do so, but we've been so focused on, you know, the actual mechanics and nitty-gritty of playing the game that no one's really sat down and said, well, hang on, are they going to make a character builder specific to Next? Are they going to be able to put together adventure tools that'll help people? I hope they do, but we're looking at a very different kind of beast with D&D Next than we have been with 4th edition, and I'll say I think it's a little more difficult to work on characters, especially on the monster side of things,
mm-hmm,
than it was in 4th edition.
Oh, absolutely. In 4th edition, the way you put characters together, it was the bucket model, which we actually, Russell and I together, still use that sort of terminology because it works really well. You have a bucket.
Oh, yeah.
A metaphorical bucket. I guess you could make your own bucket, but that would be silly. You have a bucket, and you know how much experience you need or you want the encounter to grant, and you throw in creatures that grant up to that many experience. So if
as
you,
well as traps and environment.
Right, and it's all done by experience. So you say, well, I want this to be this much experience, based on the level, and of course there are charts and tables that allow you to figure out, you know, a difficult encounter for a party of four at level five. It's much simpler than just saying it. But you have your bucket, and you fill your bucket with experience, and then once you're done, you upturn your bucket onto your game mat, and you're good. A great model, made it really easy to put stuff together, because, I mean, it's kind of modular in a sense. You take something, it costs something, put it in the bucket, subtract it, go on.
And I think that portion of the idea of being able to design an encounter with a bucket in mind, I think to an extent that's going to stick around. The thing that concerns me,
mm-hmm,
are the level of monsters and how you adjust those. Like in D&D Next, or in 4th edition D&D, I'm sorry, you had monster levels, and it was revealed pretty early on that you can really shift those around with almost impunity,
mm-hmm.
and they'll hold up to a certain extent. You get a little fiddly once you start skipping entire tiers, you know, from adventure tier to heroic tier, from heroic tier to paragon tier and onward. But if you just, you know, if you increase something a level, then you increase all of its defenses by one. If you increase it two levels, and its attacks. If you increase it two levels, then you add one to all the damage that it deals.
Mm.
So you could tell pretty quickly, okay, I'm going to jack this thing up six levels. That's a plus six to defenses and attacks. That's a right. plus three to damage. And you could, you know, easily take a level one goblin and turn it into a level 10 goblin.
Mm-hmm.
You may do one or two small things with it, but it was a very scalable system. And having spent time playing with Next and converting Next over, kind of pseudo-converting a third edition game into a Next game, I'm having a little difficulty trying to wrap my head around how you do that scaling when you get into Next. So that's why I'm kind of wondering, because the adventure tools were really good about this. You know, you could go in, you could crank up the levels, it would auto-set a lot of those numbers for you. Which was arguably one of the problems with Next, with 4th edition, was because there was so much math behind the scenes to create these, you know, really well-done monsters. It was scalable, but it was still a lot of math going on at once, and the digital tools really helped with that. I'm just not sure how much they're going to be able to help out, other than having, you know, a compendium where you can go look up the details if you want to, and kind of create your own monster from scratch. I just don't think that scalable aspect is going to be able to be kept over in Next, because it's just different enough.
Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I hope they don't get into doing is basically trying to avoid the appearance of anything that looks like 4th edition. I worry, in my sense, that 4th edition by a lot of people is seen as a failure of a system, which it absolutely wasn't.
Right.
4th edition was not a failure of a system. It was a very successful system-wise. Now, what do we attribute the demise of 4th edition to? Well, I would say there are two things. One, the backlash from the 3.5 and earlier adepts that allowed Paizo to create Pathfinder, which is the first time D&D has ever really been challenged in the general RPG market.
Yeah,
because
it really
Pathfinder,
fractured
like
this.
It really did. And a lot of people just wrote off 4th edition because it was a bunch of grognards. In the past, they were kind of, to a certain extent, forced, if they wanted to be on the cutting edge of D&D, forced to move on to whatever the next thing is that Wizards did. With Pathfinder, and I've talked at length about my problems with Pathfinder, so I won't get into that here. Pathfinder took it, they used the D20 system, and they created a game that was better than 3.5, but essentially 3.5. So you had a lot of fans, and it's that kind of hipster mentality, too. It doesn't hurt. You have a lot of fans that wrote off 4th edition to begin with and stuck with Pathfinder, creating the very first time D&D in its history from the 70s and TSR actually had something to compete against in the tabletop role-playing game, sitting around with just dice and paper and friends market. So that's the first thing.
And on the very, very, you know, same level of, you know, dungeons and fantasy.
Exactly.
And,
it's
know,
a direct, it was a direct competitor
yeah.
to 4th edition. The second thing is the creation of, which the second thing in and of itself is a reaction to the first thing, but it made things worse, which was D&D Essentials. Which and it's a curse word. I hate to say it.
Excuse me while I go hurl in a corner somewhere.
I hate to say it. But it was terrible. It became the thing that they were coming out with more. It poisoned the water hole. To quote Woody from Toy Story, someone poisoned the water hole. There's a snake in my boots. Well, this was the snake in everybody's boots, because it screwed everything up. They release it. They've renamed all of the classes. Well, is that a knight or is that a fighter? Is that a paladin or is it a cavalier? They renamed all the things. And and they tried to make it coexist with 4th edition, and it really just, that was the death knell. Had they not done that, had they stuck with 4th edition, I think we could have gotten another couple of years out of it. That's the reason we really went to 3rd edition, and I go through all this to say, I fear that some of the things that 4th edition did very well will be ignored or refused, we'll say, just because they don't want it to seem like the second coming of 4th edition. 4th edition gets a bad rap, and both Russell and I are 4th edition fans. We both enjoy it. We've both played 3rd edition. We've both played what was essentially 1st edition. I don't think we have a whole lot of experience between us in AD&D. I know I don't. I know the monsters, but I don't know the actual system. But we've played what's essentially 1st edition when we did, which you may have listened to, last year when we did the White Box Project.
Yeah.
So we know the systems, and between us we've played many other systems. We know the systems and are still fans of 4th edition because of the things that it did right, which we've gone over before, yada yada. So I go to say, I think, Russell, your point that they could have an issue with that really great scalability from 4th edition, I'm a little concerned that they may take that issue and be perfectly okay with it because it's not 4th edition E, and we want to avoid being 4th edition E, which sucks.
Yeah.
Because scaling your monsters like that was fantastic. Because you got out of that really cliche, that was the cool thing with 4th edition, is you could get out of really super cliche games. Because what's the cliche game now? Go in Direth, and then goblins show up, or kobolds, and then you kill goblins and or kobolds. And then you have orcs, and then usually some sort of undead thing, like a wight, and then you just kind of branch out, and you can go demons, you can go undead, you could go bigger orcs with trolls, and depending on what the campaign is. But that's really what you would consider a very cliche D&D game. Dire rats in the basement and all that. And I say this having just run a game where there were dire rats in the basement. So, I mean, that's an okay thing. But at the same time, it didn't allow you to do stuff like you could do in 4th edition. In 4th edition, you could start out with orcs and men and go into stronger orcs and stronger men. You could fight goblins at 10th level and it would still be, you know, an encounter. I remember going against when we played our 4th edition game that Russell DM'd the last one. I remember playing, and late in the game, we encountered two, like, goblin sneaks that just about laid waste to the party, because they were, you know, using poison and flipping around, and they were very ninja-like.
Those are my favorite, especially in Eberron, those are my favorite things to do, is, like, you come across a party of four goblins. The four goblins are level 15 ninjas, because that's what goblins do in Eberron.
Yeah, they become ninjas. So,
but it was easy to take something and scale that up.
Yeah, you could do a level 15 dire rat if you wanted to.
Right, but...
And that's great.
There's a couple different elements to that from a DM, from a design kind of standpoint. Mm-hmm. You can relatively easily reskin almost anything into anything. And, you know, I could take a fire beetle. Mm. I'm looking through the bestiary. I could take a fire beetle. And I could find something else that's fire-ish at level, you know, 8, 9, 10.
Mm.
And I could say it's a fire beetle and just, you know, adjust how certain attacks it makes. Like, I could take a fire elemental and say, oh, it's a fire beetle. And, you know, make one or two adjustments and turn a level 10 creature in the bestiary that was not a fire beetle into a fire beetle.
But you tend to lack that spark of realism. You lack that, oh, well, this is something a fire beetle can do that's special to being both fire-using and a beetle. It becomes a little more generic a monster, is essentially what I'm saying. Without a ton of work. If you wanted to add a ton of work into it, then sure, you could make your own. But again, you shouldn't have to create a brand new monster for everything you want to do.
Yeah, because when you had a short amount of time, there were two things that you could do to very quickly design monsters. One is the reskin. Mm-hmm. The other is you depower or empower monsters, especially in 4th edition. You know, you scale it up, scale it down.
Mm-hmm.
Give it one nifty little side ability or one ability unique to that encounter and call it good. Simple, done. You could design a monster that was unique to your encounter, that was the level that it needed to be, 5 minutes or less.
Right.
And there are some other systems that do similar aspects or take those ideas and put them in a different kind of package. Like 13th Age, one thing that I personally really enjoyed was that you had a set of tables or three sets of tables that were basically, here's a large monster for every level. Here, it basically a blank template for what a base large monster looks like at first level through 20th level. Here's a blank template for what minions look like. Here are their attacks, here are their hit points, here are their defenses. And you can take those and basically use them like blanks and then, mm-hmm. you know, adjust one or two things here and there, and you would have all the math that you needed to worry about done for you ahead of a session. So I could take a thing and make a random encounter in 30 seconds, just picking a little bit from this table and a little bit from that table. And that's an interesting way to do it. And then I just skin it however I want to. Mm-hmm. It's just, I don't know how much of that, you know, it relies a lot on the DM to be able to provide the additional flair, which really works those creative muscles a bit as you try to find a way to make a monster that's essentially just blank into, you know, a fire-breathing method that is running around and pranking your entire party.
Right.
And you turn that from, you know, basically just nothing. You just know that it has one attack expression, one defense expression, and then these are how many hit points it has.
Mm-hmm.
That takes a ton of work from a creative standpoint. Some DMs prefer to spend that time that they would spend creating on the mechanics as opposed to on the creativity of individual monsters. Because, you know, the DMs, monsters are essentially their game. It's them creating the monsters is like creating characters for them. And if you, you know, want to spend the time working on that, then that's one great way to do it. But if you want to spend time on the other thing instead, you shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't be able to have all this flavor and stuff kind of built in and baked in a way that, you know, you look at it and you go, oh, that's really neat. I'm going to keep that and I'm going to use it on these other monsters. So I liked 4th edition in that you could scale and reskin almost everything. But I like a couple of other things about Next as well. And honestly, I think they're going to find a way to blend them together. We just haven't been, you know, the curtain hasn't been pulled back on that yet. That's kind of what I see happening here, especially when we get to release. More DM's tools, once they really nail down the numbers on their monsters especially, they're going to come in and say, okay, here's what we've been doing behind the scenes. You guys maybe kind of figure this out a little bit. Here's how you can simply do, you know, stuff like this. Here's how you can make a level 1 monster, level 10 monster. I don't think that they're going to leave those core concepts behind just because they were really, really done well in 4th edition.
Speaking of release, what this email sort of gives us is an idea of when we might see D&D Next actually for sale. If they're going to essentially take the 4th edition tools down in March, right?
It doesn't say they're taking them down. It just says that they are not updating them with new content.
Right, they essentially put them in a box.
Right.
If they're going to put those in a box in March, what does that tell us about when we could see D&D Next?
My thing is, they said we're not adding, you know, new content, we're not developing new stuff. It sounds like they're basically going to take the people who were in charge of that, turn them around, and say, okay, now we're loading and spending all our time working on Next tools or the Next database.
Right.
The same way that they were working on the 4th edition database.
Right.
Because it doesn't make sense for them to completely abandon that model and, you know, those resources.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make sense to have put together both a really nice compendium that's searchable, a really nice adventure tool set that you can make it and level your own monsters, and a really, really nice character creator. It doesn't make sense to have people who have been putting that stuff together and then just say, okay, you're going to have to learn and come up with entirely different stuff for Next. I think that they're just going to have to take a month or two, and they're going to really work on getting the stuff preloaded and ready for when Next launches,
right.
And then we're going to see Next. very soon after that.
So happens. 2 months from there would be somewhere in the neighborhood of May. Now, Gen Con is in August. Comic Con is at the end of July. All of your cons really start taking off in August. So you're either going to – so you're going to see, I think, somewhere between May and August – or they could hold back, keep that entire, keep all that time, push it forward to May or to August and do a big Gen Con Indie August, here's D&D next, and really blow it out in August.
And, you know, that honestly probably makes the most sense. I say a month or two, but that's assuming that they have been able to build this stuff and had it ready, and they just need to spend time getting the databases together.
Right.
It's entirely possible that they just have to switch gears entirely to put the whole thing together and get it nice and clean and ready for Indy. So, you know, ending the updates in March and then going the 3 or 4 months, however many from there to August, it makes sense.
Yeah.
It makes sense that they would need that.
It's about 5 months.
Period of time.
About 5 months get does everything. Make sense.
Yeah.
So we can expect, I would say we could very, we should expect it by Indy or between May and Gen Con and Indy, which isn't so far away.
Yeah, and it matches kind of what we've been saying before. We expected them to have it ready for Gen Con.
So unless something major happens.
Yeah, the other option is they release it, you know, like in March, right after that, and I don't necessarily
I don't think they would launch it unless they were really going to start working on something else new for Gen Con, because I know this year's Gen Con, they didn't have as much as they have in years past.
Yeah, but I would here's one thing that I would definitely expect. I would definitely expect around that time to see a steady build-up to Gen Con.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, it makes sense. If they're saying we are no longer to be updating with new 4th edition stuff at that time, it makes sense that they're switching the entire team over who's in charge of, you know, doing stuff for...
Right. They're going to go...
To next.
They're going to put their nose to the grindstone and really work it out in time for Gen Con.
Yeah.
So they'll really be focused on it. And I think they'll also be focused on marketing it up until Gen Con. So you'll start seeing previews. You'll start seeing all of the – you'll start seeing – you know, we'll find out between then and then what those tools will be. We'll know a lot more about monster creation, if only based on the ampersand and legends and lore columns. We'll really get that whole thing. So there will be a lot to talk about between May and August as far as D&D Next is concerned, which is fun. I'm looking forward to picking up a new book and seeing what they have. We've been continuing a D&D Next playtest. It's still going pretty well. There are some things that I don't personally like, but I believe they'll probably get those things fixed, because it seems like stuff you would get in a playtest that just isn't, you know, ideal. So we'll see. I'm looking pretty forward to it. You know, speaking of playtest, we have been doing something that we've alluded to on the podcast a couple times, and I'd like to take a minute or two to talk about it. Many moons ago, there have been multiple times Russell and I have tried to create our own role-playing, tabletop role-playing game system. We've attempted at least twice that I can remember, if not more than twice, in the past, with varying degrees of success. Some, we took it out to a certain point, I think we just sort of lost steam. Some, we took it a little further and just kind of didn't quite fit properly. Well, recently, we've had this sort of between us a campaign setting that Russell's done a lot of writing for, and we've both done a lot of work on, called Open Range, which is a Western style / steampunk / colonial campaign setting. Originally, our plan was to write the campaign setting for 4th edition D&D. Obviously, that wouldn't be a super great idea moving forward, because 4th edition D&D will become kind of niche, a lot like people who still play, you know, advanced and 1st edition. It'll become more niche and less cutting edge. So what we've done is gone back to the grindstone to create a new tabletop role-playing game system. I've taken the lead as far as doing the mechanics of the system. We're getting to a point now, we've done multiple playtests with multiple groups. We've done, I would say, six-ish different playtests with multiple people, ranging from three or four-party groups to a big seven-party group, going through a lot of different classic things. Works. It's not a D20 license. It's completely brand new. It's something we've been working on, and we will use Open Range as the first campaign setting for this new system, which has been named OR20 or OR20 OR, of course, standing for Open Range. So in the next several months, we're going to work on getting the system finished. I'm actually on vacation all next week, and I'm going to be doing a big update to the playtest guide and the DM guide for the playtest. And then at some point in time in the somewhat near future, we're actually going to focus on the Open Range thing and getting it. Because ideally, once we get this, once we get to a point where we can self-publish it, we would self-publish both the Open Range campaign setting and the OR20 system itself.
And part of this was, you know, fueled by two desires. The setting was that we have not played or had a chance to play in any real – we were really jonesing for a solid Western fantasy, you know, D&D game.
Mm-hmm.
Deadlands is out there, and I know a lot of people, when I talk about that, that's the first thing they go to.
Right.
But Deadlands, the setting isn't exactly what we were looking for, because it's based on an alternate version U.S. history, you know. There's
right, and that's stuff and called. that's more modern, kind of modern horror, modern Western Gothic, or what I guess Western horror, Western Gothic.
I would say Western Gothic is a good description for it. But it's, you know, we were looking for something that feels very much like, hey, you got my spaghetti Western in your D&D.
Right.
Hey, you got your D&D in my spaghetti Western, and we've been kind of working towards that from a setting standpoint. As far as the system goes, we've been trying to build towards, as kind of an overall goal, something that is a little more open, something that lets you make lots of decisions that put together these disparate elements and then, you know, weld them onto a core. And then that character using these disparate elements, you know, is extremely unique.
Mm-hmm. My rules for actually putting it together, these are the things I want to accomplish. Now, whether this is possible or achievable is two completely different things. But ideally, and these are both things that Russell and I have always held in really high regard, and if you've listened to the podcast, you probably know or have an idea of what these things are. First and foremost is the ability to have any character concept and make it viable. In D&D, you can have virtually any character concept, but especially in 3rd edition, a lot of them just weren't viable. You get into, you know, anything that's kind of outside the realm of your regular archetype of character is really difficult to do. We did a thing for a while where we were creating historical characters or heroes from literature and comic books and D&D form. And we could get pretty close, but there were always at least two or three big things that just didn't really fit.
Or at least would hold them back from
From doing what it is you want them to do.
Yeah, because the fun part of playing a character, like we made a Green Lantern
style.
We made
Iron Man,
Captain America, Thor. Thor was actually really fun.
Mm-hmm.
But making all of those, all of them usually had one or two things that held them back from being as effective as they could be, especially in, you know, 4th edition. When you get in with a character that's a really cool concept and you're like, man, I'm going to play this really interesting concept, you play it for like 5 minutes, and unless it's, you know, holding its own with everyone else, you really start to be like, man, I care less about the concept and more about actually staying effective in combat.
People are sort of – I find that people are sort of 50-50 on that. You want a great character concept, and that's important, but you will sacrifice character concept to be effective. So if you're 50-50, in my mind, the best system will allow you to have your cake and eat it too. Create your cool character concept and make it viable in combat. You know, there are also other things. Being able to min-max is not something I like. Because to me, it's never really made sense when you take a... You take the difference between a fighter with a sword and a rogue with a dagger. Without doing sneak attack, you know, the sword does more damage than the dagger. But should it really? I mean, you're just as dead. It's all about how you use it. So allowing those things to... Say you wanted a character who just used daggers, and that was something he'd like to do. In 3.5 and 4th edition, you were leaving stuff on the table. You're leaving damage on the table. You were leaving opportunities on the table. Ideally, in OR20, that's not something you would ever be leaving on the table. You can make that decision, and it will flavor your character, it will color your character, but at the same time, you're just as effective from an overall standpoint. You might not be able to hit as hard, you might not be as accurate, but you're going to be equal with where everyone else is. Secondarily is, ideally you shouldn't have to consult a book constantly. You should sort of know what you're able to do. One really big goal was allowing you to do all of your stuff all of the time, because Gandalf doesn't run out of mana and have to rest.
Yeah.
Gandalf can do Gandalfian things anytime he wants. That's what makes you a wizard. Being tied to your spellbook and having 3 spells today, and hey guys, I realize you're not out of gas, but I am. Can we sleep so I can get my spells back? Really sucks.
Yeah.
So you should be able to do all of your wizard things, all of your cool things, as often as you're able to. You shouldn't run out of them. You might not be able to do them in specific situations. You might have to set them up, because Gandalf still has to cast spells to be Gandalf.
Right.
You might have to set them up, but at the same time, you still should be able to do them.
The way that we kind of have things working reminds me a lot of a old piece of fiction that was written for Magic the Gathering way back when. And in it, there was a wizard who had summoned a creature, and the creature was doing its bidding, and it was kind of against its nature, but in the end there was a big showdown with another wizard who sent in something to destroy his rival. And this wizard was sitting behind a ward, being very calm and patient, despite, you know, his summoned creature being ripped apart and all the other defenses falling around him. And it took him forever, but he finally cast that one spell that he needed to do, and it did what it needed to happen. Mm-hmm. He risked a whole lot, but he was able to get that spell off. And it wasn't that he could do it once per day, it was just that he was very vulnerable while he did it, and it took a long time to set up.
Right. So ideally you would get into that sort of situation. So being able to create your unique character that can do things, and being able to do those things all the time. Ideally, if you're a wizard, you never have to hit anything with your stick at all. In fact, you likely lack that ability entirely, because wizards don't hit things with their staff unless they're wizards who do that. Your regular wizard has a book, he wears robes, he casts spells. If somebody gets in his face, he's like, meh, not a big fan of this. Gandalf is more wizard fighter, he carries a sword.
Yeah, like a battle mage.
He's more of a battle mage. Battle mages would be able to do that. But if you're just a wizard who casts spells, you're not going to hit things with your butt. At the same time, you can set a guy on fire from across the room, and that's just as effective, if not more so.
Right.
Secondarily, is the DM should have the ability to do cool stuff and not take forever. This kind of runs back to what we were talking before. Sort of what we laid out as far as having this sort of modular thing is very similar to the way that a DM in OR20 would create a character. I don't say all this to promote the system. I just kind of wanted to let everybody know this is what we were working on in case we reference it later on down the road. And if you're listening and you're at all interested in this, I'm going to be looking for people to play test outside of our group of people. So if you wanted to shoot us an email to girpodcast@gmail.com, may be able to hook you up with some documents, may be able to get you roped in if you're interested, you know, just kind of throwing it out there, and we will keep everyone abreast. as to what we're actually doing publish-wise and where we are on the whole thing.
And there's actually, I've been writing some fiction in the setting. That's you can find that on my author page at Writer Lot.
I'll put a link in the podcast page to it.
Yeah.
If you're interested more in the campaign setting,
yeah.
I'll throw some information on the podcast page. You can go check that out. So that's sort of, I've referenced this big project that we've been working on, and that is that. So we'll keep everyone sort of up to date on how that's going and how that's working out. And, ideally at some point in time, we'll be able to point you to somewhere you can go and pick it up and play it and have a good time. Because from what we've play tested so far, it actually works a lot better than I thought it would coming out of the gate.
Yeah.
We're having, the play tests are a lot of fun, and some people are just assuming the games are going to continue. Which, who knows, maybe it will.
I mean, there's really no reason not to. No. To just really continue to just hone it, mm-hmm. hone it, and move it. And the thing that always struck me about, you know, making a new game, someone had written, I remember reading this in either the Kobold Essays about creating your own game or somewhere else, that you know that you're at the point that you're a game designer when you want to play a certain game and it hasn't been made yet.
Right.
And so you have to go out and make the mm-hmm. game that you want to play.
And that's where we've been for a while.
Yeah.
There's always little things that just that you'll see, and Russell and I playing in a D20 game together, we can kind of communicate on a different level about things that suck and things that work well, and oh, that's it's different than just regularly playing. And there are always those, you know, healing has always been really shitty in every game I've ever played. It's never worked well. It's always been just shitty. So you kind of have to do something completely different with healing. Magic weapons and the whole player world economy thing has never, in my estimation, ever worked really well. Gold kind of becomes meaningless because you will get everything you need through your regular course of adventuring, but at the same time, you still need rewards. But if gold doesn't really work, and then you say, well, you could buy houses or titles, but not everybody likes that stuff. So it's, you know, and it's always seemed like, I mean, of course there are some things where it's like, well, it just doesn't work that way. You can't please everybody all the time. You have to make decisions. But it's always felt like the decisions could be made better to a point where more people could get a lot more out of it. And ideally, that's where the system will come in and be hopefully semi-successful.
Yeah.
I hope, anyway. But, you know, we were going to talk about Christmas movies coming up here pretty soon. It's not movies about Christmas, but movies that are released in Christmas. Yeah. But we're kind of out of time. So we'll do that next week. So next week, whole podcast talking entirely about upcoming Christmas movie season movies, movies that are coming up over the holidays, including The Hobbit, which will be coming out in the next couple of weeks, including Scorsese's next movie that apparently people are just now getting to see and is glorious.
Yeah.
That movie where Tom Hanks plays Walt Disney. Hunger Games is out. I know Russell saw Hunger Games not too far away. And Anchorman 2, so we'll dive into all that really soon. But
I might have some special guests, because Macy has talked about she wants to get back on the podcast at some point. I know she's really interested in several of the movies that are coming out.
Oh, yeah, so we may be able to add both Macy and Russell. Or
and
one,
Adam, possibly.
And Adam. I meant Adam, not Russell. You're Russell. Adam's Adam. Adam was here last night. So yeah. That's yeah. So yeah, look for special guests as we move along, and you know it'll be good. If you have any movies you'd like us to take a look at, you can shoot us an email to girpodcast@gmail.com. You can also hit us up on Twitter. We are at girpodcast. As always, our music is Out Prop featuring Esset. Check them out on uhort.no. Thank you for listening.
Roll for or initiative. It's initiative. Well, we're doing or no. Stop it. We are not doing that.